Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the IPFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Andrew Lee about his new book, What's the Worst That Could Happen? Existential Risk and Extreme Politics. Why catastrophic risks are more dangerous than you think, and how populism makes them worse. Did you know that you're more likely to die from a catastrophe than in a car crash? Lee explains that pervasive short-term thinking leaves us unprepared for long-term risks. Lee outlines the biggest existential risks facing humanity and suggests remedies for them. Well, Andrew, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So as we have gone through unprecedented times of the recent global pandemic, I was wondering if you could reflect on how has it affected you and your work, and maybe some main takeaways that you have gathered from the experience.
Well, ironically, it took a global pandemic for me to think about the long term. It was while we were locked down in 2020 in Australia that a book which had been percolating in my head for the previous few years finally came to fruition. And it was the notion that populism, which has been on the rise across the advanced world, is causing us to think more short-term and distracting the world from long-term risks, some of which could spell the end of the species. Climate change, most obviously, but then also things such as pandemic risk, the risk of nuclear war, and even the risk of runaway artificial intelligence. All of these risks require global cooperation. They require long-term thinking. They require the input of experts. And they're the very things that get undermined by populists. So a more populist world, I think, is a world which is more likely to end prematurely.
And how did you have to adjust to your normal life, for example, with your traveling?
Well, we're very fortunate. My wife and I have a good setup, 3-patient kids and jobs which can be done remotely. That, of course, isn't true for a lot of the world's population. You know, you think about the security guards and cafe workers who lost their jobs during the pandemic, and the long-term scarring for careers of people who haven't been able to work, not to mention the direct health effects of the pandemic. So it was inconvenient for our family, but compared to most of what the world faced, we're extraordinarily lucky.
So could you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
So I'm a member of the Australian Parliament. I entered Parliament in 2010. I represent the seat of Fenner, which is in the capital city of Canberra. And before entering politics, I worked for a while as a lawyer, a policy advisor, and my last job before going into Parliament was as a professor of economics at the Australian National University. As a professor turned politician, I try and maintain something of a bridge between the world of ideas and the world of power. And since going into politics, I've written a book every year or two on things such as randomized trials, social capital, inequality, luck in politics, and innovation, to name a few.
And how did you find this switch from economics to politics? Was it quite organic for you?
What a lovely question. I think I noticed a few things. One is that in the world of economics, what you do tends to be produced either on your own or with a couple of collaborators, whereas politics is much more of a team sport. It's a matter of bringing a large group of people on board with your ideas, and so it tests your power of persuasion more so than does economics. And there's also less of a premium placed on cute, quirky, or unusual ideas than there is in academia. The other thing I noticed was the increased emphasis on the need to build those long-term relationships. And you know, the best thing you can do for an economics colleague in a seminar is to point out the fatal flaw in their paper and tell them how to fix it. But if you stand up in a party room meeting and try that, it's not always greeted with the same warm response.
And what would you tell our younger listeners and students perhaps who are considering the career in politics?
Oh, absolutely. It is the most diverse and interesting job I've ever done. You get to spend, I'm just thinking back over the course of this week, I've had the chance to discuss with colleagues some policy ideas we might take to the next election in my areas of Treasury and charities. I've met with local groups of Hazaras from Afghanistan about what's going on there, with Hindus from Bangladesh about some of the interracial violence, and also talking with local businesses about how they can get back on their feet. So the sheer diversity of conversations you get to have is quite remarkable. While many of my colleagues still leave me in the dust in terms of their ability to engage with people, I think I've become more of an extrovert after moving out of what is ultimately a very introverted profession in academia.
So your latest book, What's the Worst That Could Happen? Existential Risk and Extreme Politics. I was wondering, how did you come to writing it?
Existential risk has received short shrift in politics in general. Politics is often focused on the here and now, the question of whether we should build a particular bridge or increase social supports. But there's not enough focus on things which are unlikely to happen. Politics is centered around the likely rather than the unlikely, which means if you have something like, a pandemic that might sweep across the world, there is little incentive to focus on pandemic preparedness. And so, of course, that's what we saw when COVID-19 hit, that the world wasn't sufficiently prepared for the worst pandemic since the Spanish flu. We hadn't put in place the systems that allowed us to contain the spread of the virus. The development of the vaccine, I think, went remarkably well, all things considered, but the healthcare system struggled. We could have done better and we could have saved a lot more lives if we'd thought more about existential risk. But because catastrophes are unlikely, the political system hadn't bought enough insurance to guard against these improbable risks.
Okay, so let's delve into some of the topics that you cover in your book. So firstly, why do we need to talk about the future? And would it distract us from thinking about the present?
You obviously need to make trade-offs everywhere, but I think it's a trade-off that's worth making, Galena. If you look at the amount of energy that politicians around the world spend on thinking about the distant future, it's remarkably low. And yet, if the future generations could look at us now, they would probably look at us in the same way as we look at a child playing with the parking brake of a car parked on a cliff's edge. The mistakes that we make in areas such as nuclear war and climate change could potentially shape the lives of hundreds, thousands, even millions of generations of humans to come. And so the value of getting existential risk under control is massive. One estimate from Toby Ord is that the probability of a species-ending catastrophe in the next century is 1 in 6, which means we're effectively playing Russian roulette. We need to move quickly to take that bullet out of the chamber to make sure that the world endures for the sake not only of our generation and our kids and grandkids, but for those many, many generations we'll never get to meet.
And how do we know that the risks are catastrophic?
Well, assessing risk is always tricky, but what I try and do in what's the worst that could happen is to go through some of the best evidence we have over the probabilities of those risks. We have things such as super volcanoes, which we know are pretty awful when they occur and can create effectively a blanket of material around the world, which can knock out crops and could potentially cause mass famines. We know the effect of a nuclear winter would be horrific, not to mention the people who would die in a significant nuclear holocaust. And there is risk of climate change hitting feedback loops, which would then lead not only to a couple of degrees of warming, but, in a small probability, to warming of 4, 5, or 6 degrees. At that stage, all bets are off. And the impact on the planet really is catastrophic.
And what's the difference between short-term and long-term risks? And can one turn into another?
Yeah, they certainly can. So, I think that the rise of populism is a direct short-term danger. The populist politics, which posits that politics is a conflict between a pure mass and a vile elite, is a style of politics which has proven damaging to economic growth, which has proven damaging to social cohesion. But populism also has this long-term danger, which arises because populists tend to distract us from what's going on in the future. If you're in a bar fight, it's very unlikely you're going to be thinking about your retirement fund. And populist politics can often leave us feeling as though we're in a constant political bar fight.
So what would be the key issues that we have with the current systems to be able to address some of the catastrophic risks that you have presented?
Each of them are specific, but since we're in the speaking around the time of the COP26 climate change conference, let's start with climate change. Striking global agreements to reduce carbon emissions is absolutely vital in terms of getting the benefits that come from cheaper energy, from renewables. But one of the aspects of climate change that we don't talk about often enough is that even modest reductions in carbon emissions now can have huge impacts in reducing the probability of a really awful outcome. Once we're envisaging the sorts of changes that could be caused by some of these feedback loops, you might be talking about a 75-foot increase in sea levels, which is, might sound far-fetched, but they're the levels that sea levels were at last time carbon concentrations were this high in the atmosphere. Earth has had a handful of extinction events in which more than two-thirds of the species on Earth were wiped out, and most of those have been related to the carbon cycle. So we need to reduce carbon emissions in order to take off the table the slim but very real possibility of a catastrophic outcome.
So staying with the climate change issue for a moment, I was wondering, what are the different responsibilities across different strata of society? So thinking about government, then lower down to local level and all the way down to individual.
We can certainly all make choices that will have an impact. So whether that's using a little bit less energy, putting solar panels on the roof, switching to an electric vehicle. But to a large extent, the changes are going to need to be driven by governments. That's because the incentives in place need to operate at a societal level. And you see from those countries which have managed to decarbonize most rapidly, in general, that hasn't been because their citizens have individually made particular choices, but because their governments collectively have made decisions that have decoupled carbon emissions from economic growth. And we should be optimistic about this. You look at city air quality, and that went along with economic growth up until about the middle of the 20th century, and then the two diverged, and cities got richer but cleaner. So there's no reason we can't decarbonize in the same way, continue to increase prosperity, but in a clean way.
What reasons could there be for some governments to be a little bit more reluctant to perhaps say that they would commit to certain amounts of decrease in the carbon emissions, even though perhaps their population really demands it?
Well, in part, it can be because of interest group politics. Straight out corporate donations, I think, explains some of the intransigence, say, within the US Republican Party, which has taken quite a different tack on climate change than their sister party, the UK Conservatives, which have been much prompter to act, as indeed have the German Christian Democrats. But also, it has proven to be an issue which can be weaponized by extreme politicians. And so you see a large share of the votes in the European Parliament against climate action being cast by populist politicians. You see the way in which the issue of climate change has been weaponized by extremists in Brazil and in the United States, and that the way in which climate change denialism rejects the views of experts dovetails very well into the way in which populists think. Populists are often trying to look around for elites to demonize, and climate scientists have often been chosen as one of those elite groups that have been attacked.
And then, regarding climate change, which ways do you see are the best to incentivize governments, perhaps, or even big firms to really commit, but also to act upon these commitments to reduce the carbon emissions?
Well, I think it's important to recognize the benefits of acting and the fact that there's a learning curve in solar and wind. And so the more you have uptake, the more the prices tend to fall. So there's a virtuous cycle there. And that means that greater investment in these technologies can put us onto a positive feedback loop. I think it's also worth recognizing that phasing out the dirtiest technologies is really important. So think of this as being a matter of walking down a staircase. You don't want to be jumping straight to the bottom, but you do want to be very quickly looking to reducing brown coal, the burning of brown coal, down the staircase until you remove emissions. And working with developing countries has got to be vital. China and India produce a significant share of the world's carbon pollution, so accelerating their move towards clean energy is going to be vital.
Yes, these are excellent points. So looking at the bright side, are there any examples of well-addressed catastrophic risks?
So my favourite example is asteroids. There's two movies that come out in 1998, Asteroid and Deep Impact, which talk about the danger that an asteroid might strike the Earth. That immediately leads to inquiries in Congress, and an asteroid preparedness group is set up within NASA. They've now managed to track most of the bodies which are near Earth, which might collide with us. And there's indeed even a pilot project going on over the next couple of years to look at how we might deflect an asteroid from Earth if the situation occurred. So the catastrophic factor which wiped out the dinosaurs, that is an asteroid striking Mexico, is now almost unthinkable for humanity. We've managed to deal with the catastrophic risk of asteroids surprisingly well.
And are there any examples of failures in recent history to address any of these catastrophic risks, whether natural or man-made? Maybe you have a couple of those?
COVID is one. Another is just to look at how close the world has come to nuclear catastrophe so often. There's a moment during the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis when a Soviet submarine dives to avoid detection. The US ships nearby begin dropping depth charges, which are just practice depth charges, but the Soviet submarine commander thinks they're real depth charges and thinks that war has begun, and so orders the use of a nuclear torpedo, which is almost as powerful as the one that exploded in Hiroshima. And it's just the coincidence that the fleet commander happens to be also on board that submarine and refuses to allow the order to go ahead, which prevents a nuclear torpedo being launched in 1962. There's been other close shaves to do with Russian radar mistakenly picking up a Norwegian meteorological rocket as being a missile, which again could have ended in catastrophe. So taking missiles off hair trigger alert ought to be a very high priority, as indeed should be reducing the number of nuclear warheads and not increasing the number of countries with nuclear weapons.
That's incredible when you hear these stories after they happen.
Terrifying, isn't it?
So I was wondering, what could be done in short term to improve our approach to mitigating and thinking about catastrophic risks?
Well, in the short term, we can quickly move to reduce the risk. So every single nuclear weapon is a potential point of failure. You think about the risks of attacks from terrorists, the potential for somebody who is mentally disturbed and in charge of a nuclear weapon to let it off. We need to reduce the arsenal there. In terms of other risks, one we haven't talked about so far is bioterrorism. And there are still too many places around the world that are allowed to have access to some of the most dangerous bugs which have ever been invented. We need to improve the biosecurity of those laboratories and make it harder for terrorists to use technologies such as gene printing in order to create new bugs which could potentially threaten humanity.
Do you see the biowarfare as a really prominent catastrophic risks for the future?
Yeah, I do see it as a significant danger. You know, you think about the attack of sarin gas by the Arm Shrinko group in Japan, which cost a significant number of lives. And they had been looking at getting their hands on nastier bugs. Smallpox is one that you worry about a great deal. And there's also been what's called gain of function research. That's attempts by scientists to make bugs worse, effectively to build something which has the infectiousness of measles, but the killing ability of Ebola. If you're able to do that, that would be a terrifying bug. And right now, there's not enough constraints around so-called gain-of-function research. It's too easy for scientists to decide upon themselves that they will work at trying to see how bad a bug they can make. Now, I understand the argument on this, that by thinking about the worst bugs, you're able to potentially protect against them. But I can also see very easily how these things would slip into the wrong hands.
And thinking about technological side, so do you think that AI or mass surveillance or anything that we do on our social side of media, I suppose, does this pose any risks?
So artificial intelligence is the one which I think causes more people to roll their eyes than anything else. Perhaps that's because it's a staple of science fiction movies such as Terminator that we think, oh well, this is probably a bit silly. And there's a general notion that artificial intelligence directed the right way will naturally make the world better. But there's enough serious artificial intelligence researchers around who are worried about the potential for an artificial intelligence, once it exceeds human capability, to have a set of objectives which are at odds with ours. They might regard humanity pretty much like we regard our pets. They're there for our entertainment rather than us being there to give them the best possible lives. And of course, the intelligence gap between a superintelligence and humanity would quickly become much bigger than the intelligence gap between our dogs and cats and ourselves. So there is it is important to have in mind what the safety protocols would look like as artificial intelligence development continues. Now, I stress there's a lot of uncertainty about that. We don't know whether the point at which computers exceed human ability is 20 years away, 200 years away, or 2,000 years away, but it's pretty clear we'll get there at some stage. So this is actually the catastrophic risk that most people rate as being the largest, the one with the largest potential to end our species.
So that talking about human and a machine, and when we think about technology between humans, so when it comes to privacy and data protection, do you think there's risk?
That's more in the realm of non-catastrophic problems. I mean, I certainly worry an awful lot about the way in which the tech giants have been behaving. We've just had the Facebook files leaked, and Frances Haugen, the whistleblower there, came and spoke to a group of Australian parliamentarians about what was in those files, and it's pretty disturbing. I think the tech giants could do a lot better in terms of maintaining data privacy and also on issues around how their platforms can be used to spread hate speech. Indeed, when I mentioned before having met with a group of constituents of Hindu Bangladeshis, that prompted me to write to Mark Zuckerberg asking him what he is doing in order to ensure that there are enough Bengali language moderators in Facebook to control the potential for the platform to be used for hate speech. So I worry about that a lot, but Galena, I put that in a different basket from the catastrophic risks. I think that the artificial intelligence that Facebook is using is problematic for society, but I think superintelligence is potentially catastrophic.
Yes, that's a really useful distinction. So now thinking about the bigger picture and reflecting on society a little bit, so in what way the perception of the existential risks is being shaped by our political and economic forces of the day? So do we have any risks that are in vogue at any given time?
Right now, of course, pandemic preparedness is in vogue, and we're probably doing much better in terms of being ready for the next bug now than we would have than we were in 2019. But there's still the rise of populism, and for every moment where someone says, "Oh, we've beaten back the populists," the Results from the German election, for example, seemed to indicate that the Alternative for Deutschland had slipped backwards. Then you've seen the US midterm elections in 2021, the November 2021 elections, which appear to have reported an upsurge in the number of populist candidates there. And that indicates that populism continues to be attractive, particularly at a time in which many people feel as though the economy isn't delivering for them. I talk about the causes of the rise of populism as jobs, snobs, race, pace, and luck, meaning that when your employment prospects are bad, when you feel people are looking down on you, when you feel as though minorities are getting more than their fair share, when you feel the world is moving too fast, and when the leader happens to be especially charismatic, then the lure of populism becomes larger.
And do we need to stare risk right in the face in order to do something about it?
I think it's useful to do so. We do that all the time, of course, with home insurance. So most of us have insurance on our homes. And we do that because we're staring right in the face the prospect that our home might burn down. Now, that prospect causes me to go out and buy insurance, but it doesn't prevent me from going to sleep at night. I know it's a very small problem, but I also know that if it happened, it would be catastrophic, which is why I've got a home insurance policy. And it's also why I don't have an insurance policy on my mobile phone. Losing my mobile phone would be annoying, but not catastrophic. And yet much of what we're doing in politics seems to be focused on problems of the level of will my mobile phone get lost compared to will my house get burned down, and recognizing the importance of investing a little bit more in averting catastrophe. Now, in economic terms, the expected value of doing that can be extremely large.
So what discoveries along your journey to writing your book, what's the worst that could happen, surprised you the most?
I was surprised by the degree of consensus in the artificial intelligence community about artificial intelligence risk. So I'd gone into it in imagining that there would be a strong divide between philosophers who thought that this was something to worry about and artificial intelligence researchers who told everyone to go away. And, you know, there's a bit of that. There's a famous line by the researcher Andrew Ng, who says it's like worrying about overpopulation on Mars. But by and large, there is acceptance within the artificial intelligence community that this is a problem worth thinking about. It's not a problem that should be used to impede development, but getting the ethical standards right is important, and building into the systems some ability to think ethically and to have those ethical values updated. Because what you probably don't want to do is to encode just the ethical values of today into machines for all time. Imagine if we'd done this 100 years ago, we would have locked in a set of ethical values that were more racist, sexist, and homophobic than those that we appreciate today. And so it's easy to imagine that society's ethical values will shift over time, and having a super intelligence able to learn about our ethical values will be important.
Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to hear, something that we haven't discussed today?
I think the ability of all of us to have a conversation about the long term, and the notion that while this might sound catastrophic, and it is, you know, there's plenty of movies about catastrophe, it is also a fundamentally optimistic picture. I love the notion that there are ancestors of mine who will live lives of unimaginable beauty and pleasure, where they'll get to enjoy food of greater quality than I've ever tasted, a world of greater aesthetic pleasure than I've ever known, hopefully to live for much longer than I will, and to do so in collaboration with others, which provides a real sense of meaning and purpose. And it's those almost infinite numbers of lives that I want to preserve and to foster through writing this book. The story of humanity is fundamentally a really optimistic one. And what we have to do is to take that 1 in 6 chance of catastrophe, dial it down to 0, and therefore ensure that our ancestors, many generations of ancestors, can live phenomenal lives.
Oh, that's a beautiful message. And then which movie is your favorite from the catastrophic movies?
Oh, look, I think it's pretty hard to go by past Bruce Willis's Armageddon. I thought that was good fun, but there's a lot of good pandemic movies out there, and disaster flicks. So if you want to do your research by sitting in front of the screen, I think that's a great way to learn about catastrophes.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. Can you tell us what are you currently working on, and what will be your next project?
Well, we've got an election coming up any time. Australia has terms. The election term is set by the Prime Minister, and so the Prime Minister can call an election at any point. So I'm really focused on helping my Labor colleagues put together policies for that election and campaigning in my local electorate. I've always felt that being a Member of Parliament is a privilege and never a right. And it's important to be there for people, to engage with the local community, to be as accessible as possible. The best sort of campaigning is where you're out in the electorate solving local problems. So I like to think that I'm not just out there shilling for votes, but actually trying to make a positive difference in my local community. And my community is pretty extraordinary. The city of Canberra is now has 94% of the over 12 population vaccinated and is fast on track to becoming the most vaccinated city in the world. So I'm pretty proud of that, and pretty proud to represent them in the federal parliament, and hoping to do so again after the next election.
And where can our listeners find more information about your work and also your book?
So my website is the modestly named andrewlee.com. I'm on Twitter, easy to find there. And the book is available in ebook and hardcover form wherever good books are sold. Look forward to hearing your views on it. If people have read it and want to continue the conversation, please do get in touch.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining me today and for this thought-provoking discussion.
Thanks, Glenna. It's been a pleasure.